Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What could motivate a 67-year-old great-grandmother to walk more than 2,000 backcountry miles all by herself? Emma Gatewood set out in secret in 1955, but as soon as word got out that this senior citizen was the first woman ever planning to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail, she became a sort of overnight celebrity, and she used her moments of fame to advocate for better maintenance of this American treasure. Americans at the time thought they knew all about Gatewood, but as my guest discovered, she may have hiked not only, as she told reporters, because she felt like it, but also as a way of healing her spirit after decades as a battered wife. Ben Montgomery is a staff writer at the Tampa Bay Times. His new book is called Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. He is in town for a signing event this evening at 7 at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff. Ben, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks very much.
So you are like distantly related to Grandma Gatewood.
Indeed. She was my mother's great aunt. So I was born in 1978 and she died in 1973. So I never had the pleasure of meeting her, but she is in the family.
How much did you know about her when you were a kid?
Well, I felt like I knew a lot. I remember falling asleep to my mother telling me stories of Grandma Gatewood, as she was called. The stories included her scaring away a black bear with her umbrella while she hiked the Oregon Trail. And you know, sort of these wild and riveting bedtime stories that always had me fascinated. But it turns out I knew very, very little about what she actually did. And a lot of what my mother relayed wasn't quite in keeping with the truth of the story. It turns out the true story was so much better than anything I knew, and really anything Grandma Gatewood's direct descendants knew.
It's amazing how myth grows up around stories that aren't even that far in the past.
Sure enough. Yeah, we crested Mount Katahdin as part of research for this book, and we did so on a day in which about 30 thru-hikers finished their trip. This was 2 years ago. And I waited for them to have their celebratory time at the end of this long, long, months-long journey, and then approached them just to see what they knew about Grandma Gatewood, because there is lore out there. And I remember one fella, maybe in his 20s, I said, you know, what do you think of Grandma Gatewood? And he said, man, you've got to respect somebody who hiked the trail barefoot. And it turns out, you know, she blew through 7 pairs of sneakers, but she was never barefoot so far as I knew. So there is a myth that exists certainly along the trail about her and what she did.
So every time reporters would ask her, or anybody would ask her, it seems like she was like this story of Meatloaf telling people how he got his name. It's different every time. She had a lot of different answers.
She did. She told him, I did it on a lark. I wanted to see what was over the hill and then what was over the hill beyond that. She told them, you know, because I wanted to. It came down to that. And it turns out it was a lot deeper and darker than that. And that was the interesting part for me. Her family kept a dark secret for a long time, and she herself lied through her teeth to the reporters who asked some, you know, limited biographical information. She told them she was a widow when, in fact, her husband was alive and well back in Ohio.
So she was married at 18 after, ordinarily you might call it a whirlwind romance, but basically she was really pressed by the man she married to make it official.
Sure enough, he was much older. She was 18. He was 29. He was well-respected in the town. He had a job as a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse. And he came from a family that was well-to-do for southeastern Ohio. And so, yeah, there was some pressure. She wasn't ready for marriage. He sort of twisted her arm a little bit and said, no, this is what you want to do. And so she finally relented and agreed to be his wife.
And within, well within a year of their marriage, he was abusing her on a regular basis.
It took a matter of weeks before he hit her for the first time, as she wrote in her diary. And yes, within the year, she was the recipient of a lot of beatings from him, and that would continue for 30 years.
There are these stories of his kids being afraid of him, and the idea that when they would hear him getting up in the mornings, they would have to sort of spring to and be ready to do whatever he said.
That's right. They had a moderate sized farm. They grew tobacco. They grew vegetables, and the kids all had responsibility, and they all got punished if they failed to keep up with their responsibilities. So the children remember starting work as young as 2 years old, collecting eggs from the chickens. You know, at three, they would sweep floors. At four, they were doing their own laundry. So it started very early. And I don't think that was necessarily uncommon at the time. I just think he ran his house with a certain amount of order that may have been slightly uncommon. Certain amount of strictness that you know, that was over the top at times. They remember him. By the way, they remember him spinning off, and you know, he was a smart guy, but he would lose his temper and spin off. And two of the kids that I interviewed, the kids, they're in their 80s now, but two of them remember him beating a horse nearly to death with a leather strap. You know, for the horse failed to do its job, I guess, and he went off on it. So that wasn't uncommon.
And he quite literally got away with murder at one point in his life.
That's right. There was a dispute with a farmhand, Hiram Johnson, and as the story was passed down through the generations, it ultimately came to be that Hiram had threatened Perry Gatewood and sent his son home to fetch his gun. And so, having heard this, Perry sent his own son home to fetch his gun. And about the time that two boys made it back with the weapons, Perry Gatewood swung his rifle and connected with a previous wound from a previous scrape on Hiram Johnson's head and killed him dead.
So for Emma Gatewood, who first of all has ultimately would have 11 children to support, and nobody was talking about domestic violence at that time, and it sounds like maybe no one in the town would have believed her or been on her side had she confided in people who could have helped her.
I think you're right. I think everyone minded their own business, frankly. It was a small town. You know, culturally, I don't think you would have had any kind of a support system there outside of maybe her family members. And so I think she, you know, she was alone. Besides that, Perry lied about her. He would often tell people that she was crazy. He would often threaten her with sending her to a mental asylum. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty common for him to say to her, you need to pick which hospital I'm going to put you in, you know, because the time's coming.
How did she finally get away?
Well, after 30 years of abuse, first of all, she had slipped away twice before. She had family that lived in Southern California. And on both occasions, she had received a horrible beating from her husband and decided it's time to leave. And she left for California and would stay for a matter of months, 8, 9, 10 months, and ultimately returned. She still had two young daughters at home and a son, and she feared for their safety. She also needed somebody to pay her medical bills from the abuse that she received. And so she returned returned home twice to Perry. And ultimately, they had one final fight that convinced her that it's time to get away and get away for good. And the kids had grown up a little bit more. They were teenagers at the time. So she still had three at home, but kids who could ultimately take care of themselves, basically. And after this particularly bad fight in which Emma wound up in jail, she decided to file for divorce. And Perry did not oppose that request. And so she ultimately was granted a divorce and left him for good.
All right, I want to step back here and talk a little bit about the Appalachian Trail. How did it come about in the first place, and what did – it was the WPA ultimately that worked on construction?
The WPA was part of it, but it was the idea of a man named Benton McKay, and he also turns out to be the sort of forethinker behind the interstate highway system. Yeah. But McKay –
what a strange coincidence.
Yeah. It's wild. But McKay was standing on top – the story goes, he was standing on top of a mountain, I believe in Massachusetts, somewhere in New England, and looking south over the Appalachian Ridge. And he thought, there should be a footpath that stretches from the north to the south somewhere to preserve sort of wilderness, to preserve one very long hike in the United States before – you know, before it was crisscrossed by roads. And at this point in time, the interstate highway system didn't exist. There were, you know, several thousand miles of a paved highway, but nothing even close to what it would become. And so he started, he wrote a story for a magazine at the time, and it got a lot of attention. And he and others started working diligently to try to make this dream a reality. And so in the 1930s, they began to piece together stretches. They began to acquire permission for the trail to cross private property. They began to buy land and encourage the government to buy land so that the trail, you know, was consistent, was linked from all the way from north to south. And they engaged other clubs, hiking clubs, along the Appalachian Mountain Range to also get involved and to commit to maintaining their stretches. So ultimately, in the 1940s, the trail was finally pieced from Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia to Mount Katahdin in Maine, roughly 2,000 or 2,100 miles. And it should be noted that at the time, Mackay, none of the early founders ever thought that anyone could hike this trail in one season.
Right.
It wasn't the intention of the forefathers to have a through hike. They thought, frankly, it was impossible. And so it wasn't until 1948 when Earl Schaefer, who was walking off World War II, sent a letter to the Appalachian Trail Conservancy from Maine saying, I've just completed a through hike. I walked the entire trail in one season. And people doubted him at first until he showed slides and his diaries that he kept along the trail. So that was the first through hike in 1948.
You said that there were different organizations that committed to maintaining the trail. By the time Emma Gatewood made her hike, some of them were doing an okay job with this and some of them were not.
Right. The trail at that time, 1955, it was not well known. Earl Schaefer brought a certain amount of attention to the trail, but ultimately it was, you know, a handful of newspaper articles and not much more. In 1949, there was a story with color photographs, a 9-page spread in the National Geographic, and this brought a lot of attention. This is how Emma first learned of the trail. She found that magazine in a doctor's office and read it and sort of fell in love with the idea of trying to walk the entire thing. That article painted a very roseate picture of a through hike. It suggested that one may, quote, hayfoot, strawfoot from Georgia to Maine, and that the trail was wide as a Mack truck, and that there were sleeping arrangements within a day's walk. She found that not to be the case. She found portions of the trail that were unmarked, and she was pretty regularly getting lost and having to find her way back to the trail. There were stretches where storms had caused great blowdowns. Trees were crisscrossing the trail and that sort of thing. And then there were times when there was no shelter, which she would learn. So she'd, you know, reach the end of a day's walk and there's no shelter and she'd have to bunk down in the woods or introduce herself to somebody who lived nearby and, you know, invite herself in essentially.
And if she had to be on her own, she'd have like an old shower curtain, right, to keep the rain out?
That's right. Her gear was incredibly meager. She carried supplies in a handmade denim drawstring sack that she slung over her shoulder. And she had a gingham dress that she could shake out and put on in the event that she walked through a town. She didn't want to be seen in her dungarees. She had bouillon cubes to suck on for salt. She had a Swiss Army knife. And not much more than that. Band-Aids and bobby pins and Vicks salve and a shower curtain to keep the rain off of her.
1,000 executives at REI just died a little hearing that.
Sure enough.
My guest is Ben Montgomery. He's a staff writer at the Tampa Bay Times and author of the new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. He's in town for a signing event this evening at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Ben Montgomery. His new book is called Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. He's in town for a signing event this evening at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So something that should be pointed out about Grandma Gatewood is that not only was she 67 years old, you know, these days there are a lot of very fit people up into their 60s and 70s. She was like 5'2". She was 150 pounds. She had bunions. She didn't look like some kind of, you know, meta athlete.
Yeah, you're right. She was a weathered weathered person, farm girl, right? She had been working alongside the men on her farm since she was 18 years old. She did not have the physique of a hiker, if there is such a thing. She wasn't athletic. She didn't know how to swim. But she was sturdy, and she had the sense of, just like ultimately an endurance, I think, because of the hard life that she lived.
And she did prepare before she went. She was taking like 10-mile hikes.
Right. She was always a walker. She never drove a car. And so if she wanted to visit a friend, she walked. And often that was 10, 15 miles one way. So walking wasn't new to her. In advance, you know, this was a secret. She didn't tell her children. In advance of her trip, her kids later learned that she had been, heading off into the woods and outside of her hometown in southeastern Ohio, and neighbors would see her sort of traipsing through the forest. And I think that was probably her attempt to test herself against nature to see what she would need out on the trail. Like I was mentioning before the break, ultimately that was very little. She didn't need very much.
So she didn't tell her kids in part because she thought that they would say, this is crazy, don't go. But she'd also had a thwarted earlier attempt.
She tried to, they call it southbound. She tried to hike from Mount Katahdin south in 1954, the year before. She made it to Maine and climbed Mount Katahdin and headed south. And within about 30 miles, she got desperately lost, to the point where she ran out of food, couldn't find the trail, and she wrote in her diary that she sort of essentially laid down to die. She said, if I'm going to die, this is as good a place as any. She caught a second wind and tried again to find the trail and find a way back out of the wilderness. And she ultimately did, and she made it back to the ranger station at Rainbow Lake in Maine, which is not far from the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. And there were four rangers who had been looking for her in an airplane. And she found them playing horseshoes one evening as she stumbles back in. And they said, this is no place for a woman your age. One of the men she wrote in her diary said, go home, Granny. And so she did. She realized that it was a little more difficult than she imagined, and she returned home, and she never told a soul about that. She found it to be very embarrassing. She would connect again with those same rangers the following year, this time in Maine at the very end of her journey, and they were supportive. They were glad to see her again.
So initially she kept it a secret, and her family wasn't, people might be thinking, how did they not freak out when she disappeared? But she had, as you mentioned, she'd left before, and they sort of knew she'd eventually be fine.
Yeah, none of her children were worried. And I think my mother's in her 60s, and I think, you know, if I didn't hear from her for a while and found out that she was trying to through hike the Appalachian Trail, it might be cause for some alarm.
Yeah.
But they weren't worried. They knew that she could take care of herself. And I mean, for heaven's sake, she raised 11 children and put up with 30 years of spousal abuse. So they didn't know that she had told them, I'm going on a walk. They didn't know what she meant until she reached Roanoke, Virginia, which is, about 9 weeks on the trail, 9 weeks of walking 20 miles a day. And she dropped a, she had been found by the newspapers, and she dropped a postcard in the mail back home and said, explained what she meant by taking a walk. And it was, according to the historical record and what her children remember of finding out that first time, nobody was really worried. Nobody was concerned. She was their mama, and she could do what she wanted to do.
Okay, so the newspapers found her. Initially, people said, hey, can we tell the papers about you in the local places that she'd stop? And she said, no, I don't really want that. How did things change when she decided, okay, fine, I'll tell you a little bit about what I'm doing?
She had let slip what she was doing to a man standing outside of a gas station near Roanoke, Virginia. And the way I was able to figure this out, he contacted two members of the Trail Club who also had some affiliation with the Roanoke Times, the newspaper. So they tracked her down. It took them several hours to find her on the AT, but they finally tracked her down at Bear Wallow Gap, which is just outside of Roanoke. And they said, we'd like to, you know, people should know about this. We'd like to tell your story in the paper. And she said, no, I don't want that. She was afraid of somebody might try to harm her while mm-hmm. she was on the trail. And she also wasn't doing this for attention. They said, well, at least let us put you up for the night. And so she agreed to stay in a cabin that was owned by the local trail club. They took her. They agreed to meet about 10 miles down the road because she wasn't done hiking for the day. And so they took her pack as insurance that she would stay with them. And so they put her up in the cabin, served her dinner that night, and kind of sweet-talked her a little bit, told her that people would be really interested in this and that it might be something that was useful in terms of bringing attention to the Appalachian Trail. And she finally, late that evening, relented and said, all right, so let's do this, and answered a couple of questions and a pose for a photograph. And then the word was out, and it spread like prairie fire through the Appalachian Range.
I bet she never imagined herself in Sports Illustrated magazine.
No, I'm sure she didn't. Well, Sports Illustrated at the time was, I think, a year old. So her first story actually ran on the one-year anniversary of the first edition of Sports Illustrated, still a fledgling publication at the time. But I think you're right. I don't think she ever envisioned what was to come, not just with Sports Illustrated, but with daily dispatches about her whereabouts and her condition from the Associated Press that ran in newspapers across the country, and from the United Press International that ran in papers across the country. I don't think she ever expected that kind of attention. I don't think she expected the American people in general to start pulling for her.
So she had, like, no credit card. She had a little bit of cash.
$200.
$200.
Yeah.
And essentially, along the way, relied on her own wits and on the kindness of strangers.
That's right. She ate wild berries, wild strawberries, wild blueberries. She ate something called sorrel, which is a sort of tart, tangy grass that often grows in places along the Appalachian Trail. She ate nuts and berries and sucked on bouillon cubes and very often relied on the kindness of strangers. Interestingly, she would be criticized in later years after her death by people who said, that's slack packing is what they call it. If you're relying on other people to take care of you, you're not doing it right. But she didn't have a problem introducing herself to people, inviting herself in for dinner. I tracked down a guy in New Hampshire who remembers as a boy at the age of 9 when she came through in 1955. And he tells the story that, you know, there was a knock at the door and his mother went to answer the door. And there stood Grandma Gatewood, this battered, withered looking woman. And she introduced herself and said, I'm through hiking the Appalachian Trail. What's for dinner? And just sort of invited herself in. And that was common. She did that quite often. And people established relationships with her. She often, she would jot their names down in their diary and their location. And when she finished the trail, she would correspond with them by mail. And then in the subsequent hikes, she did it twice and three times. And she would reconnect with those same people on the trail and stay with them. She made lifelong friends with many of them.
You know, it's not so unusual. It's funny, this term slack packing. It's not so unusual to think that someone who was raised in a farm community where people helped out their neighbors, it wasn't that she was thinking this is so odd. It sounds as if she thought, well, this is what America's like.
I think you're right. Yeah, she knew everybody in Gallipolis, Ohio, and visited with many of them all the time. So it wasn't a foreign a thing for her to just, you know, sort of introduce herself. And it was 1955, even, and she was a, you know, she was a product of the foothills of the Appalachian Mountain Range. So she wasn't necessarily a stranger in Appalachia, even if there was, you know, some tension in the air with the Cold War and McCarthyism, and you know, this was a year after Brown v. Board of Education, so there were these sort of sparks of protest and racial violence in the South. So you know, in light of all that, in Appalachia, you know, there's this 1955 is this great year for bootlegging moonshine, and so there's this battle between the IRS and the law and the moonshiners. So in the middle of all that violence, there's no indication that she was necessarily really concerned about, you know, walking up and introducing herself to someone. She got turned away too. You know, some early on, a man said, who are you?" She said, "You know, do you have any food? Do you have a place to stay?" And he said, "Did Washington send you?"
Yeah,
he was very suspicious.
Story.
Yeah, very suspicious of her. So she ran into that a couple of times, mm-hmm. You know. But
and hotels wouldn't always take her when she did decide to spend money.
That's right. I mean, she was bedraggled, torn dungarees, and her iron gray hair was always a mess. You know, she didn't bring a comb with her. She wrote once that she needed to look presentable to walk through town, and so she found a fork that had been left in a campfire, and she combed her hair with the fork. One little boy saw her coming into town. This was in Virginia, and he said, "Here comes a lady tramp," and all the kids started giggling and ran away from her. So yeah, a lot of times she was mistaken for a hobo and had a hard time finding a place to stay for that reason.
So I'm not a big outdoors person, but if I even camp for one night, I bring an extra pair of glasses because I can't see without my glasses. She had the same problem, but wasn't necessarily in a position to replace her eyeglasses.
Oh, she was utterly blind without her eyeglasses, and she had broken a lens by the time she reached Mount Katahdin in Maine. So to set the scene, she had spent about three nights sleeping in sub-freezing weather. By the time she reached Mount Katahdin, it was sleeting. She had put on everything she brought, every piece of clothing that she had brought, including a couple of things that she had found along the trail. She covered her head with a rain bonnet, sort of, and but she's hiking with one broken lens that had completely fallen out of her glasses, and the only lens that she, you know, that she could see through kept fogging over from the temperature. So. And if you've ever been to Mount Katahdin, I mean, there are stretches of Mount Katahdin where they're called the monkey bars. You have they're sort of iron bars stuck into the sides of boulders, and you have to literally pull your own body weight up these monkey bars like you're climbing a ladder up a flat-faced rock. So I can't even imagine how, you know, how this woman was able to do this in those conditions, not being able to see and trying to fight through the sleet. Something.
Was she more concerned about natural hazards or people she might meet along the trail that weren't friendly?
Probably more concerned about natural hazards. I say that because so in 1955, this is one of the stories her family never knew, but in 1955, these two back-to-back hurricanes made landfall 7 days apart off the coast of North Carolina and ripped their way up the eastern seaboard, dumping tons of water and stalling out ultimately over New England. And the flooding was so bad, it killed 211 people in New England. It literally wasted small towns along major rivers in New England.
And as you say, most of them had houses who were killed in that storm.
Right. Most of them had houses. It brought train traffic to a halt at Grand Central Station in New York, the most rainfall on record and in a 24-hour period in New York City. And she was alone, exposed to the elements in the Green Mountains of Vermont. Now, she never wrote in her very meticulously kept journal, she never wrote about the hurricanes. I don't think she knew that they were hurricanes. She would write, for instance, "It's very wet today. Slogged 9 miles through water," things like that. Hmm. But she was unaware that there were hurricanes, soaking her. She made it to Clarendon Gorge in New Hampshire, and it was swollen. It was a raging river at this point in time, and she couldn't make it. She didn't feel safe. She couldn't swim. She didn't feel safe trying to cross it on her own.
It's 40 feet across.
40 feet across, mm-hmm. And steep walls on each side. And so she sat down on the trail and waited for two boys that she had met a few days before who were on a hike. They had taken a break or leave from the Navy, and they were 19 and 20 years old. And she waited for them. They finally reached her, and the bridge across the gorge had washed out. And she told them her predicament and showed them the raging gorge. And they came up with a plan. They decided to tie her between them with parachute cord so that all three of them would walk across the river together. And so they did this. They strapped her in the middle with the parachute cord, and they started inching across the river. And eventually the water comes up to her knees and then to her waist and then to her neck. And she can't look at it because she's scared to death. She, you know, has to just stare straight up at the sky. But ultimately, after this tense situation, they get her across, and she makes a joke about it. She says, well, boys, you got Granny across, and boom, and off she goes, you know. I tracked these guys down. They're both in their 80s now, and I tracked them down. And it was so intense an experience for them that one of them still has nightmares about trying to get across that gorge. Hmm. So the elements were not in her favor on that first through hike.
We're speaking this hour with Ben Montgomery, who is a staff writer at the Tampa Bay Times and author of the new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. He's in town for a signing event this evening at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Tampa Bay Times staff writer Ben Montgomery, author of the new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. He's in town for a signing event this evening at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. That is where we find Robert on the line in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Chris. How are you today?
Great. Thank you.
I just tuned in, and I heard that this story was about AT through hiking, and I'm a former through hiker myself. One of the things that I've learned about the Appalachian Trail is that anybody can do it. I mean, stories like you're talking about today with Granny. When I started the hike, I was 22 years old, and I finished the hike with two recent retirees who had just turned 55, as well as another young man my age who the first night he'd ever spent outdoors was his first night on the Appalachian Trail.
Wow.
And people always say, how did you do that? And I always tell them, you know, you just do it. You really learn what you're capable of on the Appalachian Trail, and you learn that you can do anything if you just put your mind to it.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Robert. Do you think, Ben, that it's as much mental as it is physical?
Yes. I think it's, well, having never through hiked, I mean, I tracked Grandma Gatewood's ghosts along the AT, mm-hmm. but I've never through hiked. I do, and ultimately I think Robert was right. I think it's just putting one foot in front of the other 5 million times, and that's what gets you through. So the statistics, 1 in 4 people who start a through hike wind up going all the way. And they're expecting about 1,000 people to finish this year, so, which suggests to me that about 4,000 people would attempt a through hike this year. And that's been slowly increasing since the time Grandma Gatewood started walking. But yeah, I think it's more mental than physical, as she showed. You know, 67 years old and beat up by the very end. It has more to do with determination and mental stamina than it does physical stamina, I think.
Did she get lonely?
She, on the contrary, she wrote that she had never felt an aloneness more complete. Hmm. She enjoyed the solitude. Especially near the end, you know, when she started getting a lot of attention, and the newspaper reporters were tracking her down and staking her out, it started to annoy her that she had to answer the same set of questions every time, and so I think that made the periods of solitary hiking even more rewarding for her. She liked that solitude very much.
Talk about these journals that you've referred to so many times. It sounds like she kept amazing records and shared not only events, but also her emotions.
Yes, she kept a legal-lined, small pocket notebook with her along the trail, spiral-bound, and she wrote in it every single day. Some entries were much longer than others. Beyond that, she corresponded with a lot of people, and thank goodness her youngest daughter, Lucy Gatewood Seeds, kept all of that correspondence and kept her mother's journals and kept her mother's scrapbooks, which were especially helpful for me in trying to do this book and trying to do it accurately because, as you know, the newspapers don't necessarily get it right every time. But fortunately, Grandma Gatewood would clip the articles and put them into a scrapbook and then edit the articles. She would correct her quotes and correct mistakes in the margins. And so this was really useful in terms of setting the record straight because the stories did spin off sometimes. If I could go back for a second, I think what Robert said is interesting, that he finished the trail with two 55-year-old retirees and a young man his age, 22. Anecdotally, I think the statistics would probably bear this out, but when we crested Mount Katahdin the same day, about 30 people did in 2012, the thru-hikers were either young people, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, that age group, or they were much older, 55 to 70. And I think there's probably this gap that exists in the age demographics, the people who through hike, because we get stuck in the kind of American inertia. You get a mortgage, you get kids, you get a job, and it's really hard to break away for 3 or 4 months to go take a long walk. So I think you got people who are not committed to much and aren't sort of established in society doing it. And then you have people who have decided, this is what I want to do in my free time in retirement.
How did so much mythology, I mean, you mentioned, you know, some facts that might have been wrong in the newspaper stories, but how did people get the story of Grandma Gatewood so wrong over time?
I think there was some bad reporting early on, you know, similar to what we see now. If, you know, somebody will have a breaking news story and then someone else will sort of rewrite it and add their own.
It's like playing telephone.
Exactly, telephone. I think that happened, you know. I also think a lot of what was passed down about her was passed down by word of mouth. Somebody would meet her on the trail, you know. Mistake her for a hobo, find out who she was, and then tell the story to, you know, a friend, and that friend would tell the story to someone else, and on and on, and it just became kind of bigger and less connected to the truth. And there's evidence that happened a lot, which is why I wound up, I think, probably hearing that, you know, this guy respected her, because you got to respect anyone who hikes the trail barefoot. that wasn't at all part of her experience.
And she wore Keds because she couldn't tolerate other shoes. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's no indication in her written record that she ever even thought about buying hiking boots. She just I'm taking a walk, so I'm going to wear sneakers. And it was, the Keds thing is something that's been attached to her that's not necessarily totally correct. There's evidence that she wore Keds and Chuck Taylors and, nondescript men's shoes even. It was just what she had on hand or what she could find or what somebody gave her, that she wore. And she left shoes all over the place. You can still find her original shoes in a couple of outfitters along the Appalachian Trail, including one in Damascus, Virginia, which has a pair of, I think, of her Chuck Taylors that sort of encased in glass there.
When she came back, she was not only reported on in newspapers and magazines, but she was all over TV.
Yeah, most of that came at the end of her hike of the Oregon Trail, which came in 1959 when she was age 71. And she had heard about a wagon train that was trying to reblaze the Oregon Trail from Independence, Missouri to Portland, Oregon to celebrate the Oregon Centennial. And she thought, well, I don't have anything much to do this summer, so I'm going to do that as well. And she ultimately caught up to and then passed the wagon train and became something of a dignitary. The governor of Oregon made her an ambassador at large and sent a certificate that she could carry in case anybody ever gave her problems. This is who I am. I'm hiking to Portland. And so she was received in Portland, Oregon in 59 by 5,000 people, many of them dressed in colonial garb, and they walked about the last 3 or 4 miles with her into Portland. It was a big deal. They put her in an Oldsmobile and drove her down Burnside, in the back so she could wave to the crowd that had gathered, put her up in the nicest hotel in town, the Benson, flew her in a helicopter over Portland. And this was around the time that she got a lot of media attention on television. So she appeared with Groucho Marx in L.A. on You Bet Your Life alongside an author whose name escapes me. Groucho Marx Show, the Dave Garraway Show, the Today Show, and then on various, television stations, both in Appalachia and on the West Coast.
Did they fully respect her as an individual, or did they try to sort of make her into a character?
I think they treated her like an oddity, mm-hmm. Groucho Marx had fun at her expense. She didn't like him. and she was sharp, she mm-hmm. fired back. She was something of an oddity. Why would somebody at your age do this? And I think she had earned the respect of America at large, but she was a little bit of a sideshow, a sideshow freak when she was on, had the attention of the media.
She lived into her mid-80s, is that right?
Yes, to 83. I'm sorry, 84. Died in 1973 at the age of 84.
You had become so close to this person. Obviously, you knew how it ended before you even started reporting on this. But I wonder if it was strange for you to know that you were chronicling the end of this story.
It was such an odd experience. I'm a newspaper journalist for 13 or 14 years now, and this is my first book. And doing this was a very weird experience. As I hit about the 50,000 word mark, I started crying as I would sit down to write, and it had nothing to do with her death. She's still alive. She's still touring the country, doing amazing things. But and looking back on it, I mean, I'd sit in my office and try to write her story and wind up just in a mess of tears. And in retrospect, I think I was afraid of, I'd kind of fallen in love with her as mm-hmm. a person, as a human being. And I think I was afraid of her death, or like mourning her coming death, because I knew I had to go there in the writing. And to this day, I can't read that chapter I wrote about her death without, shedding tears, because she became alive for me, having trying to get inside of her head and spend so much time trying to recreate her and bring her to life in the book. She became a real person, and I didn't want her to die.
We should let people know it's not a harrowing death. She dies naturally. And she doesn't. It's not on a walk or anything. And I hope I'm not spoiling things there to say she dies peacefully. But I understand what you're saying. Is it too simplistic for me to see this parallel between, you know, writing long and hard every day for a newspaper, but it's these short bursts, and then writing something as long as a book, and taking short day hikes and hiking the Appalachian Trail?
I think that's on the money. Yeah, this was a through hike in literature. I think you're right, and it was a very neat experience. I want to do it again. I'm ready to do it again.
Did you find a need? Like, I mean, you're touring with the book. It just came out a couple of weeks ago. Was there a point between finishing, and I know the editing process is long, and then there's a delay before publication. I mean, did you need to kind of rest and collapse after the writing was done?
I set this up all wrong, I think. I did. I had a year to do the book, mm-hmm. What I thought was a hard deadline. And so it took me about 8 months to report everything out. My last reporting trip was to climb Mount Katahdin, which I knew was going to be the kind of climax of the arc. And I got back home, and I remember I had like 84 days to write 70,000 words. And so I set up this writing schedule of 1,000 words a day. And I couldn't quit my newspaper job, and so mm-hmm. I was, doing work for the Tampa Bay Times, and then coming home and trying to put my three children in bed, get them fed and washed and put in bed, and then I'd go out to my office and sit down and try to come up with 1,000 words, and it was just a real challenge. And so I blew the first deadline. I was close, but I blew the first deadline and got an extension of 45 days. And hit that pretty good. I had about 15. I finished the book with about 15 days to do my own editing, to distribute it to some close friends for quick reads and feedback. So that pace was frenetic, and I think I'll do it differently next time.
And I guess the last thing I want to ask you is, when you hiked Mount Katahdin, was that the first time that you'd been there?
It was the first and only time I've been there.
Did you feel like a strange connection to her when you were actually on the trail that you didn't expect?
I definitely did. We hired a guide, Paul Santacondro, who was the superintendent of trails at Baxter State Park, which is a fantastic wilderness preserve in Maine. And we gave Paul all of the information we had from image journals and from what the trail looked like in 1955. And we asked him to try to recreate the exact same footsteps that she would have taken up the trail. And he was able to get very close. And so we started about 30 miles out and hiked to the base of Mount Katahdin, and then chased her ghost up the mountain. And much of it was in the darkness. It was just a beautiful experience of connecting with this woman that I'd been thinking about for months and months and months.
The new book by Ben Montgomery is Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. You can meet him this evening at 7 at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Oak Cliff, where he will be signing copies of the book. Ben, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
I can't thank you enough for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Katie Daniel. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.